the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk. Samuel 13, verses 7 to 14. Some Hebrews even crossed the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul remained at Gilgal, and all the troops with him were quaking with fear. He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. So he said, "Bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offerings." And Saul offered up the burnt offering. Just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived, and Saul went out to greet him. "What have you done?" asked Samuel. Saul replied, "When I saw that the men were scattering, and that you did not come at the set time, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, I thought, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favour.' So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering." "You have done a foolish thing," Samuel said. "You have not kept the command that the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command." And now 2 Samuel chapter 6, verses 12 to 22. Now King David was told, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the Ark of God." So David went to bring up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. When those who were carrying the Ark of the Lord had taken 6 steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. Wearing a linen ephod, David was dancing before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel were bringing up the Ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. As the Ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. They brought the Ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it, and David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women, and all the people went to their homes. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, going around half naked in full view of the slave girls of his servants, as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord, who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me to rule over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes, but by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honour."
If you were paying attention yesterday, which bit of the Monopoly, which Monopoly piece would I use above all others? Racing car. What we're going to be doing this morning is racing through bits of 1 Samuel. Didn't you love the fact we had a reading from 1 bit of 1 Samuel, then a bit of 2 Samuel? So hopefully everything Liz and I say is biblical. We'll try and give you references as we go so you can go home and check out what we said. That helps because we'll have left by then, so it doesn't really matter. You won't be able to find us. But rather than going, as soon as one of us says, well, we're in 1 Samuel 12, spending the whole of the next 10 minutes trying to find 1 Samuel 12, and then we've moved on to 1 Samuel 14. So the references, hopefully we'll give them, but we're going to go big sweeping moves. If you remember yesterday, I talked about Saul, and some of you are ahead of me, because you reckon already Saul's lost the plot. He's out, he's no longer king. And just before we dismiss and write off Saul, I want to take you to the beginning of Saul's time as king. We're in 1 Samuel 11 at this precise moment, but not for very long. Saul has been made king, and what Samuel has said is, God is upon you. Whatever you do, you know, if you do it in God, it's going to work. Get on with it. And Saul, the first thing that happens is that Nahash the Ammonite besieges Jabesh-Gilead. And he's a fairly horrific bloke. He says, the only way I will offer you peace is if I can gouge out the right eye of every man, so that for the rest of history, people will look at you as a one-eyed generation and they'll know you're humiliated. And in a very bizarre way, they say, well, okay, we're not very keen on that. Give us 7 days. We'll see if we can come up with another solution. 7 days' time, you can take our right eyes out, but give us 7 days. And they send out a messenger, and the messenger goes rushing off, and they go rushing to Saul. Now, Saul, just to confuse you, has traded his donkeys for his cows now that he's the king, and he's out in the fields plowing. The problem with the Bible is we are so culturally so far from there, and there are bits where we just don't get it. Let's just trust that we don't need to get it. As Ricky Gervais says, God's so much bigger than our little brains. And if Ricky Gervais says it, it must be true. So he's there, he's plowing with his oxen. The people come rushing in and they say, this is what's happening. Now, I haven't got time to go into it, but if you're really up for some intensive Bible study and you can have dinner with John Allen later to explain it to you, Jabesh-Gilead is really important in terms of history and story. In terms of Benjamites and everything else, there's all sorts of things with concubines and people being chopped up into pieces and being sent around. And there's some history and context that there's repetition here. That as soon as Saul hears what has happened, he takes the oxen he's plowing with, he chops them up into pieces, and he sends them to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he says, this is detestable. We need to respond. It even says that he is angry in God. It says in 1 Samuel 11:6, when Saul heard their words, the Spirit of God came upon him in power and he burned with anger. This is a real God moment for Saul. And Saul calls all the people together and Saul goes and attacks and rescues Jabesh-Gilead. His first act as king is a Spirit-empowered act. It's right. It's good. And the people are so impressed, they say, we want him to be king so much, we're going to go for a second coronation. They have him kinged again and crowned again. The first time round, when he was, the day when he was hiding with the donkeys, there were some guys there watching who said, we don't want him as king. We don't think he's a very good king. And after this act, it says in 1 Samuel 11:12, some people came and said, who was it that asked, shall Saul reign over us? Bring them to us. Let's put them to death. Let's mark out that this guy is king by killing some people who opposed him. And Saul says, no one shall be put to death today, for this day the Lord has rescued Israel. Listen to that, because I think you'll find that's the only time Saul in his entire time puts the glory to God and puts himself down. At this point, on that day, Saul is saying, it's not about me, it's about God. Sadly, he'll never say it again. Because move on. Chapter 12, Samuel stands up and says, my job's done. I step out. I'm not needed anymore. You've asked for a king, you've got a king. As long as this king obeys God, as long as you obey God, it'll be okay. I step back. You'll have to step forward again in a little while. But he's really saying, that's it. And then the story continues. 1 Samuel 13. Jonathan, Saul's son, is a fighter. He's an amazing man. We haven't got time to study Jonathan, but if you want to look at somebody in the Bible, somebody who never really comes to preeminence, in fact, gives away his preeminence to David, but is an amazing man of valor and of courage, but also a man of God, it's Jonathan. And it's interesting, isn't it? We can be so caught on the big names that we don't notice the really important people that don't get the big names. Yeah, without Jonathan, David would never have flourished. Without Jonathan's grace and his encouragement and his support and his protection, where would David have been? And it may be for some of us, you're called to be Jonathan's more than anything else. For our children, when we were first, or when they were very young, some people prayed for them and prophesied over them. And one of the words is that they would minister together. And another thing was that one of them will support the other one. that he will be the one who just is there to keep his brother in what God's calling him to do. We don't know what that looks like, what that means, but I think that's so exciting. That sense of being in it together, but not needing to be the same, not needing to both be up front. So Jonathan. Jonathan's the man who basically in the next couple of chapters, Jonathan's the one who is going to go and stir it up. He's going to go, come on, let's fight the Philistines in a godly kind of way. And he goes out and he starts a fight with his sword bearer and it all goes particularly excitingly. And then the response, I love it, is Saul turns around and Saul says, look at me. Look at me, because I have made us an offense. 1 Samuel 13. Jonathan attacks the Philistine outpost at Geba, and the Philistines heard about it. Then Saul had the trumpet blown throughout the land and said, let the Hebrews hear. All Israel heard that Saul has attacked the Philistine outpost. Saul hasn't got out of bed. Jonathan's done it. But Saul's saying, look at me. Saul, you know, Saul was a man of the wrong time. Saul should have been on Twitter. Saul should have been at Saul the Tall, right, at King Saul the Tall, and he would have tweeted, I've scared the Philistines, come to Gilgal to fight. Hashtag, the Philistines are going down. He wants the world to know. He wants everybody to notice Saul and think it's all about him, that he's the one. And there are loads of people out there, aren't there, like that? Christmas letters are the preeminent way we see it. People that want you to know how amazing they are. Their Christmas letter is full of actually really not how amazing they are, but how incredible their children are. Deflected glory. Someone I know, his comment whenever he goes to his children's speech days is, oh, we'll need to take the trailer for the prizes. In what way is that a helpful comment? There are people in ministry, and I think Twitter doesn't help, who it's all about, look at what an amazing job I'm doing. Look at me. Aren't I great? And they can do it in terms of it's trying to glorify God. But a lot of it is people bigging themselves up. And why do we do that? In whatever way we do it, why do we do it? Because actually often inside we feel quite small. We were, when we were first married, we were in Oxford, full of lots of people that are big in their own eyes and also lots of them who are quite big in the world's eyes intellectually. And there was one guy, a member of our church at the time, who made his kind of name in belittling people. He was an Oxford academic and he would really make himself look good by belittling the people he taught, by making them look stupid or by belittling his colleagues. I have a question about the fact a member of a church can do that anyway, but isn't that, doesn't actually, if you look at him, you're not going, thinking badly of the people he's belittling, you're thinking, what's your problem? How insecure are you? And that's Saul's problem. Later on, Samuel's going to say to Saul, you were nobody. You thought nothing of yourself. What's happened? What is it that now it's all you and no God? And so Saul is sent out the tweets. Everybody's arrived to fight. He's quite up for it. He's really excited. He's there. And 1 Samuel 13, verse 5, the Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore, and suddenly he's not quite so happy anymore. The Israelites are starting to scatter. They're going, hey, hang on a minute, Saul, you said this was going to be an easy one. They were running scared. They don't look scared. It says, I can't remember what the translation we just heard read said, but it literally says in my translation, they are shaking with fear, the Israelites. There's a problem because Samuel said, quite rightly, we are the people of God. We're not the people of Saul. We're the people of God. And before we go out to battle, we don't go out under your banner. We go out under God's banner. And for us to do that, Saul, before you ever go to fight, you need to have a service. You need to worship God so the people are looking at him, not the enemy. You need to make a sacrifice. But if you remember your Old Testament law, Saul, it's not you, it's me, Samuel. I have to do it because I'm a priest. And I'll be there within 7 days. Wait, don't do anything. Quite simple, wait. And in those 7 days, the Philistines are pouring in and the Israelites are pouring away because they're so scared. To the point where Saul goes, I can't handle this. I'm looking an idiot because I got everybody by my Twitter account to come here, and now everybody's going. And in the end, he goes, what's going to happen? Look, guys, don't run away. No more of you leave. I'll do the sacrifice. Bring it here. And he just begins to burn the offerings when Samuel walks around the corner and Samuel smells the barbecue. And Samuel comes in and goes, this isn't an Esplanade breakfast. Something else is going on here. I smell bacon. It wouldn't have been bacon because they're Jews. He comes in and he says, what on earth have you done? What have you done, Saul? And Saul says, the people were scared. We had to offer a sacrifice. I just thought I should get on with it. I can imagine him going, and you weren't here. It's your fault. You let us down. And Samuel says, that's it. If that's your heart, you can't be king. What's really sad, I didn't read it to you. The beginning of this chapter says Saul was 30 years old when he became king. And he reigned over Israel for 40 years. Or if you're interested, the text note says it may be 42 years. I think the 2 years don't really matter. The important thing is he was 30. He's going to go on to being king until he's 70. I don't know when this battle happened, but probably a couple of years at the most into his kingship. He's going to carry on as king for 38 years when he's already been rejected as king. And I think that's true in many of our lives. That stuff happens and it doesn't become apparent for years. I think you see that in big Christian leaders, that they have this huge upfront national, international ministry and their lives are falling apart. And it may be it doesn't become apparent. But when they come away from God or when there's massive areas of mess in their lives, it will fall down. I think there's also something for many of us that there are times in our lives where God hasn't shown up. A bit like Samuel didn't show up. We go, well, God, you weren't there. I can't trust you. I prayed for this and it didn't happen. So I've just had to get on with it. Two women said to Jesus, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. I think often in life we have disappointment and we feel maybe God didn't show up. And we have a choice then. Do we keep waiting? Do we keep pressing into God? Or like Saul, do we go, well, God's not showing up. I'm just going to get on with it. And we can live a slightly schizophrenic life where on the one hand we're going, I believe in God, I trust you, it's all for you. But actually in our heart, in our way we act, we're living as if, well, it's all for you, Jesus, but I can't really trust you because of that which happened. And we move on. Saul has massive insecurity, which he never deals with. But also he's lost his trust in God. He takes things into his own hands. We go on from there. And there's another battle. I haven't got time to talk loads about it, but it's fascinating. I think Liz will mention it at some point, that the next battle, Jonathan again preempts a battle in chapter 14. And this time Saul's kind of like, well, hey, hang on a minute. I made a mistake last time. I've got to bring God in. I'll get the ark. I'll get the ark in, and then we'll find out what God wants, and we'll go for that way. But it says, literally, before they've actually consulted the ark, before the priest has done anything, Saul sees the people, and he goes, hang on, we're going to have to go. We're going to have to just fight. And he pulls back. He also, that day in chapter 14, makes a massive vow. He's so pumped up. He's so like, this is amazing. We're so good. I tell you what, we're so spiritual. Nobody eat. We're fasting. We're fighting for the whole day, but we're fasting. If anybody eats, they should die. There's interesting things about the fact Jonathan eats and Saul's happy to kill him because he doesn't want to look stupid. He's made a vow. He'd rather lose his son than break his vow. But also interestingly, that day in chapter 14, they fight the Philistines. And because they're so exhausted and so tired and so hungry, they don't kill the Philistines as they should have done. And the Philistines live to fight another day. If Saul that day had done as God said, hadn't made big vows, I wonder whether the Philistines had been wiped out and the rest of the story would have been so much easier. But that's something else. Move on to the next chapter. They fight the Amalekites. When they fight the Amalekites, God says, don't take any prisoners. Don't take any plunder. Kill the lot. Wipe them out. That's all you've got to do. Samuel's not around. I don't know what Samuel does the rest of the time. He's probably praying because he's a priest. And that's what priests do, especially in the Church of England. But Samuel again turns up a bit late. And the whole battle's over and is finished. And he walks in and he goes to Saul and he goes, did you do what you were told? Saul's like, yeah. I did it all. It was me. And somebody goes, hang on a minute. I can hear something. What can I hear? victory. Now I can hear sheep. What's the sheep? And Saul goes, well, I did exactly what you said. I killed everything, wiped everything out. But we kept some animals. You're going to love this, Samuel. We kept some animals to worship God with. The victory's his. So we've kept some sacrificial animals. And we kept a king as well. That's fine. And Samuel again goes, you don't get it, do you? You really aren't going to be king now. You've got to do what God says. If you don't do what God says, then you're not God's leader. If you don't do what God says, then you've got the face of a believer, but you're not living it. And the same's true for us, isn't it? We can make a big show and dance. We can do great sacrifices. We can do great worship. We can go and try and convert whoever we meet. But if we're not living God's way, we're not going God's way. We can't say, I'm all for you, Jesus. And yet have areas of our life when we're doing stuff that God says is wrong. And you can take the Bible and you can argue most things around the Bible. Yeah, you can twist the Bible to say what you want. You can say, well, when the Bible says don't do this, well, you know, it was of a season and things are different. Or if you read this version of it, well, if you read it in the ancient Greek, I'm sure you could change the meaning. And nobody's going to know the ancient Greek enough to argue. But actually, the Bible's quite straightforward about some stuff. And I wouldn't worry about the stuff we don't get. Do we do the stuff we do get? How many of us, if we're honest, have areas we're not doing what God wants? And there's a little conscience within us, the spirit within us saying, it's wrong, but we push it down. This is slightly awkward. Liz is speaking second. That's not awkward. That's lovely. But so I have to be on time. And I was planning on doing that with Saul. And now we're going to look at David. Before we do that, also, Samuel says to Saul in that bit, he says, you are no longer king. That is it. It's all over. And so Saul goes, oh, I'm so sorry. I've sinned. And some of us do that, don't we? Like, oh, I'm such an idiot. I've got it wrong. And we get sorrowful. It talks in the New Testament about sorrow rather than repentance. And Saul's like, oh, I'm sorry, Samuel. Look, Samuel, why don't you come back with me? Come back with me before the leaders. Okay, I may not be king in the future, but come back. Don't leave me. Don't leave me. Don't make me look like I've been abandoned. Don't make me look like I've been rejected. You have to come back and worship with me because I don't want the people to think that I'm not it anymore. Saul's worry is what the people will think. It's not Moses when God at one point says to Moses, my presence is going to leave. I'm so fed up with the Israelites, the fact they won't go my way. I'm going to take my presence from you. And Moses is like, don't. If you're not with us, then there is no point in us. God, I am not leaving this place until you promise you'll go with us. Saul, rather than going, God, I don't care whether I'm king or not. I want you. I don't care what people think of me. It's all about you. Saul is so concerned with what people think. It's like almost stuff the God bit. Just don't make me look an idiot. Samuel, don't make the people see that I'm not king anymore. Come back with me and worship with me. And that is in complete contrast to David. Fortunately, you all know David's story, so I don't need to go over it. But look at David. David, his first entry into the story is, well, after the harp bit, but harps don't matter. They're too expensive. David's first entry is he comes to the fight with Goliath. And where Saul and all his army are looking at numbers, David comes in and he goes, what's the problem here?
Well, Goliath's very tall. In fact, Saul's only a head taller than us, Goliath's feet taller than us.
And David goes, David says something quite rude, actually. He gets a little bit, you know, he talks about things we shouldn't talk about. Belmont wouldn't use such language. He says, you bloke with a foreskin. He says, you've got a foreskin. What's your problem? I can fight you. Because for David, all that matters is they're God's people, and he's not. And if God's on our side, it doesn't matter whether you're 10 feet tall, 50 feet tall, it doesn't matter whether what you've got, it's all about God. David looks at everything from a God perspective. We're not Saul's army, we're God's army. And Saul and David will go on like that. You know, David writes songs. You may have heard of a few of them. And one of them is, the Lord's my shepherd. That's what it's at. But David, nothing else matters in life. You're with me. You lead me. I'll go your way. It doesn't matter. David has some horrific moments. He nearly dies at points and he goes, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, but you are with me. You comfort me. That's what life's about. I don't care what people think. And very briefly, Saul's so insecure. Saul's so insecure that he's going to spend the rest of his life, most of the rest of the book of Samuel, is going to be Saul chasing David rather than going anywhere else. David, as we had read in 2 Samuel 6, his first acts as king. The beginning of 2 Samuel, first few chapters are infighting between Saul's family and David's family. Ignore that. First thing that happens when he becomes not just the king of Israel, but the king of Judah, is that David first takes Jerusalem. He takes Jerusalem, the city of God, because he wants a place which is God's place. He wants people to know this is about God. Next, he kills off the Philistines, because that's what Saul should have done years ago, and he wants to tidy that little mess up. Because they've been offensive about God. And then the next thing David does is he does the thing Saul was never bothered about. He goes and he says, we are God's people, and if we're God's people, the most important thing is that God's glory is in our center. And we can't talk of God's glory when God's glory is manifest in the Ark of the Covenant and it's round the corner with some bloke and we're not even looking after it. And he says, what I will do now is I will bring God's presence to the center of God's people, because that's what we're all about. And he goes to get the ark, and you can read it, but he goes and gets it, and the first thing they do is they build a massive cart. They want a good, impressive way of moving an ark. And people die. David's heart's right, but he hasn't really read the rule book. And then David says, we've got to do this right. It's not about appearances, it's not about how big the cart is, it's not about whether we bring it in a BMW or a Skoda, it's about the fact we bring it with God. And so they get poles, and they carry the ark. And what David does is every six steps, he makes a sacrifice. It must have taken weeks. Every six steps, they have to start a barbecue, burn an animal, and then move on. And they do this the whole way to bring the ark. And David, rather than the end of it, going, I'm so fed up with singing songs. I'm so fed up with worship. I'm so tired. I don't want to see another cow. It says David gets more and more and more excited. David is dancing with all his might. He's so hot from dancing, he's stripping his clothes off. He's just got his boxers left on. Now, if you think about the youth of today and how awful blokes' boxers look over the back of their trousers, David doesn't look good. They're not just hanging over the back of his trousers. It's all on display. But he doesn't care, because he is there going, God's coming. I don't care what you think. I'm doing this for God. He says, somebody made a song about it. I don't care if I get more undignified than this. And people look on his own wife. You know, I don't know how many of you are married or would like to be married, but you don't want to upset your wife. You don't want to get into an argument. That happens automatically. You don't want to cause an argument. And David's there. I'm just causing one now because I should have shut up 5 minutes ago. You don't want to... You want to... keep everything happy. You want your wife to love you and be impressed by you and respect you. David says, in effect, I don't care what you think. I don't care how stupid I look. I don't care what anybody thinks about me, because all I care is about God. Yes, he does care. One of the next things he'll do is he'll bring back that wife that Saul's got rid of. But it's all about God. And what about us? Do we give in to our insecurities, to our fears? Do we live trying to impress, worried about what other people think? Or do we say, God, it's all about what you want. If there's anything wrong in my life, if I'm insecure and that's getting in the way, deal with it. I'd love you to just take 30 seconds while we change speaker and I repent on my way back for taking too long. While we have a little argument, if you'd just like to turn to the people on your table and just say, what struck you? What is challenging you from Saul and David?
James has left me with loads of time to look at my bit, so thank you. What we're going to look at now is a slight change of tack, and I just want to look at how we can be more like David than Saul. Because we want to be more, we want to be wholehearted, we want to be after the things of God, and we don't want to be distracted by things or what other people are thinking of us. We just want to live a life full of God, just like David. because David, as James said, was a king whose heart chased after the things of God. And I want to be, and I hope you want to be, people that chase after God's own heart. Saul was never really that bothered by God, because before he was made king, God didn't really figure in his life. But God knew that, and he chose him anyway. And when he chose him, he made some amazing promises to him. And in 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 6, God says to him, the Spirit of the Lord will come powerfully upon you, and you'll prophesy with them, and you will be changed into a different person. And in verse 9, when he's been anointed king, we're told that as Saul turned to leave Samuel, God changed Saul's heart. And for Saul, we can see that God does make him into a completely different person, because the Spirit of God comes upon him and he changes him from a man who hid amongst the donkeys to a man prophesying in the name of the Lord. And in chapter 11, as James talked about this morning, when Jabesh is besieged, the Spirit of God comes upon him. He gets really angry and God helps him save the people of Jabesh. He did have a few amazing God moments when he became king and God came to be with him. But he never really backed them up with a life lived for God. And so as time went on, they faded more and more into the background. And what characterized him more was what was in his heart. But right from the start, we're told about David when Samuel's gone to anoint the new king. And he sees this really good looking, handsome brother of David, Eliab. We're told the Lord does not look at the things that man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. That's 1 Samuel 16, verse 7. Because Samuel, when he goes, he's looking for another handsome guy like Saul was. And God says, no, I'm after the things of the heart. And God had chosen in David a boy who didn't really have much going for him. He was the eighth child of a man who was going nowhere. He was just a shepherd. You may know from the sort of Christmas story, the shepherds were the lowest of the low. They were the outcasts of that time. But God knew David and loved his heart. And as you read on in 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, you can see more of David's heart, because David never grasped at the kingship, even though it's promised to him and Saul is still king. He never goes after it. He waits. He goes after the things of God. He's outraged that Goliath taunts the armies of the living God. He worships, as James said, with all his might. Even though he's despised, he goes on worshipping. He does make mistakes. He can be blind to his sin, but my goodness, when it's pointed out to him, he really repents. Because before we get to know God, before we become Christians, I think we're all like Saul. When God doesn't figure in our lives, we just get on with living life and doing what our heart dictates. But God makes to each of us an amazing promise to us, that when we become a Christian, he tells us, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh, and I'll put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. And he makes that promise. That's Ezekiel 36, verses 26 and 27. So each of us are promised a new heart. But Saul, I don't think he realizes that God's promise of a new heart is not like a switch being flicked inside of us. When we grow up independent of God, we learn to act and react in certain ways and to think in certain ways. And becoming a Christian is not like pressing Alt, Control and Delete on your computer. It doesn't all just disappear. We need to train ourselves to walk in line with the truth rather than with our old habits. And that's what in the New Testament, Paul talks about renewing our minds. You know, God promises to create in us a new heart, but we have a responsibility to walk away from what we were and walk into the person and the life that God has designed and created us to live. And this isn't always easy. About 10 years ago, we used to live in Oxford. We moved into a house and the garden hadn't been touched by the previous occupants. And James is actually quite keen on gardening. So we cleared the entire garden back, kind of stripped it back to a mere nothingness. And then we were left with, well, what do we do? And James's big desire, he's about to fulfill it again in Exeter, is to have a pond. He just likes ponds. So he built his pond. He lined his pond. He filled it up with water. Bearing in mind, there was just mud all the way around it, but he was very keen on his pond. Filled it up with water, and then we went and... But he's looking outraged. And then we went and bought little goldfish, and we plopped them in the pond, and every day he'd pop out and he'd feed his goldfish. And they were his pride and joy. This was pre-children. when we had time to do things like that. And then, but as time went on, and it wasn't actually very much time, the water got murkier and murkier, and James could see his little friends less and less, and he got sadder and sadder. So we asked around or read around or whatever. I think it was a pre-Google internet day, so we had to work out what to do. And everyone said, you need to put oxygenating plants in the water. So we went to the garden centre and we bought the right plants and we bought the pretty ones and we bought the floaty ones and the sinky ones. And then James went to the compost and you can buy special compost to go in ponds. And he was like, well, that's just ridiculous. I'm not spending money on that. I've got compost at home. It's perfectly good enough. So we took all our plants home, put them in our normal compost, shoved them in the pond, and the pond got murkier and murkier, and the fish were never, ever seen again. And what we learned eventually was that you really do need to buy the right compost if you're ever putting plants in a pond, because you need oxygenating compost, and the cheap compost that my cheapskate husband had used, was just making the whole problem even worse. This is his illustration. He told me to use it. And and so the pond just got murkier and murkier. And I just think that sometimes our hearts and minds can be like that water. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." And if our hearts aren't pure, just like that water wasn't pure, then we won't be able to see God clearly at work in our lives. And I think we've all got stuff in our lives, impurities that stop us from seeing God. But in God, we have everything we need to defeat their power and hold over us. I'm just going to spend a really short amount of time looking at what might be in our hearts and holding us back from seeing God clearly. So the impurities that will stop us seeing from God are thoughts, beliefs, philosophies, values that aren't consistent with God's truth. In ourselves, we can believe lies that are simply not true, but that our environment, our family, our school, or even our friends have sold us and or have told us, and it says, you know, and it makes it true in our lives. So if you've been told consistently that you're too short, or you're too talkative, or you're too quiet, or too anything really, if you're told that enough times, then you'll start to believe it. I've got a friend. She's absolutely fantastic. She's a really good friend of mine. She's lovely, she's intelligent, and she's bubbly. But if she ever makes a mistake, she doesn't just say, oh, sorry. She goes, oh, sorry, dyslexic blonde. And she lives under that label of being a dyslexic blonde. And there is truth in it. She has blonde hair. She has dyslexia. But actually, she believes that label so deeply. And it's not how we ever saw her. And it's not how God sees her. And I think we need to be really careful how we label ourselves, because if we give ourselves labels that aren't from God and they're not true, then we don't need to come under their influence. And another thing that can stop us seeing God clearly is unresolved stuff from our past. Because if someone's hurt us and we haven't forgiven them, then unforgiveness festers away inside us. And what you'll probably find is the person that's hurt you is completely unaware of how much hurt is still going on in you, and they're off just living their lives. And we are the ones that are suffering the after effects. And therefore, we are the only ones that can deal effectively with the situation and stop it causing any more hurt in our lives. Temptation can also stop us seeing God, because temptation is the devil's way of making us live independently of God. And even David fell in this area. But I'm not going to look at that any further, as James is going to look at this story of David and Bathsheba in more detail this evening. Another thing we need to do is we need to look deep down at what we believe and what we're basing our lives on. So recently, I've just moved house, about 3 weeks ago, actually. And we were really lucky. We didn't have to make any decisions. We didn't get to choose the house, where it was, anything. Didn't even really need to choose the new schools. Kind of, God sorted all of that out. But all I needed to do was paint the house. But I've got several of my friends who are also looking to move house, and they're not really Christian. So what they're looking at for a new house, they're looking for more space. They'd like another bedroom. They'd like a bigger garden. They want good amenities. And of course, in my sort of world that we're living in, they want good schools. But if we start to believe we deserve all these things, and they're my right, because that's what my friends are doing, then what we believe will affect what we then do. Because if you believe you need a bigger house, because all your friends have one, so then you'll go and do that. And so if I went out house hunting, maybe I can't find the ideal house, But I can get a bigger house if I move slightly out of Exeter. And, well, I'll move slightly out because the schools are good and country life will be great for the kids. But then it's a little bit more than I wanted to spend on a house. But that's okay, because I'll just keep working hard to pay the mortgage. And then we move into the house and everything's great. And I work that little bit harder to pay for the mortgage. But church is now that little bit further away. And oh, I'm really tired because I'm working so hard. So I won't go to house group in the week time because that's just too much. And now I don't actually know anyone like that, but I do know the opposite because I've got a friend who's so committed and called to her church that she's been waiting to buy a house in the area of her church for 2 years and nothing seems to be coming on the market. She's living in rented accommodation. It's twice been sold out from under her. She's been made homeless. She's had to sleep on different people's sofas. And she's desperate for something more permanent. But she believes that God has called her to that church first and foremost, and she's living her life out of that belief. So what we choose to believe informs our decisions, our actions, our values, and our lifestyle. And we need to make sure we're believing the truth. The other impurities in our pond, well, they can be quite subtle because the very nature of the devil is he's a deceiver. And the more subtle the things that he places in our lives, the better, because we won't see them for what they are and we won't realise we need to get rid of them. Often other people can see the lie, but to us, to me particularly, some of mine make complete sense. And it can be hard to know exactly what's going in our hearts because we're deceiving ourselves. And sometimes we can have sort of incidents or little things that happen that highlight to us that something's going on in our heart that's not quite right. And it's kind of like sometimes something happens and as a friend of mine used to say, you've just had a grade 10 reaction to a grade 1 event. You know, something really small has happened, but how you feel about it or react about it is just way over the top. So, for example, I've got one of these in my life. We've just started on a Tuesday night. We've always had a team meeting, a sort of discipleshipy thingy, on a Tuesday night. And we've just moved them now. Now we've moved house. They're in our house. And we have food beforehand. And I've been organising all of that. And it was all absolutely fine. James's job was to set the table. And that was as much sort of authority as I gave him in that area. So he set the table. And on the table, he put a bottle of squash. And oh my goodness, I completely lost it over the bottle of squash because that's not what I planned for us to have. We were drinking water and James had put squash out and anyway, it was, looking back on it is just terrible. But I really did have quite a grade 10 reaction to that bottle of squash. And kind of, there was nothing in the whole bottle of squash, but my reaction showed me there's something else was going on that wasn't quite right and I needed to deal with it. And sometimes we have these reactions and you need to stop and think, where did that come from? Why am I so cross? Why am I so upset with that person about what they did? What's really going on? How do I deal with it? Because I think events like this, these grade 10 reactions, point to tree stumps in our lives. And if you don't know where I'm going with tree stumps, so James proposed to me. It was raining. We were in the middle of an argument. And it was midnight. And he stomped down to the bottom of his mother's garden. He dropped onto one knee. And he asked me to marry him under a tree. And I was busy going, don't ask me when we're in the middle of an argument. But he did it anyway. Anyway, all lovely. Obviously, he's fantastic. And we, you know, long story. But anyway, went to bed, separate rooms. His mum was in between us, all lovely. And next morning, when we woke up, he's now looking embarrassed. When we woke up in the morning, the very tree under which he had plighted his troth and all the rest of it had fallen down. And his mum, as well as him, is a very keen gardener. And they were just left with, oh, what do we do with the tree? Oh, that was the entire discussion the next day is, what do we do with the tree? Because you have a choice. When a tree falls over in your garden, what do you do? Do you clear the tree away and leave the stump, which is the easy option, kind of, although there's quite a lot of sawing and moving a tree, we discovered. Or do you get rid of the tree stump as well, which takes a whole lot more effort. But if you leave the tree stump behind, well, you'll probably know they have the potential to start shooting again and growing again. And if you really want to get that tree out of your garden, you have to take the tree stump out as well. So if I take you back to the bottle of squash incident, which really wasn't, you know, a huge thing, I could have just dealt with the immediate problem, which is that I got really very cross with James and was a teeny weeny bit unreasonable. I could have just asked him for forgiveness and prayed about it. And, you know, that could have been job done. But I think pretty much, guaranteeably, that was going to pop up somewhere else. Something else really small was going to happen and I was going to have, a really enormous reaction to it. So I did. I took some time to stop and looked at what the root of the anger was. Why was this squash making me so cross? And actually, it all just came back to money. So we just moved house. We've been spending huge amounts of money here, there and everywhere on carpet and paints and all the rest of it. And little by little, I'd got that little bit more fear in my life about we don't have enough money. And it just crept in and I hadn't dealt with any of it. And suddenly this one thing, bottle of squash, and exposed this whole lie. And I just thought, this isn't of God. God doesn't ever want us to be afraid. Fundamentally, fear is nothing to do with God. But this fear was stopping me from seeing God. So what I did was I took time to deal with what was really going on, which was to do with money, nothing to do with the squash. And I also said sorry to James. So what I want to do is encourage us all just not to deal with the shoots that pop up, but to look at our tree stumps. And when we're going to deal with this stuff, the way I think about it is we need to R it. And there's a bit of debate between us as to how many R's in this whole process. So I'll let you kind of count them as we go. So the first thing you need to do is you need to recognize your sin. You know, whatever it is you've done, you need to acknowledge it, that it's your fault before God. And then you need to repent of it. You need to actively turn away from your sin. And for me, I don't know about you, but for me, that can be really quite hard. I can be so full of all the reasons why my action was justified in the first place that to recognize it was wrong and turn away from it is incredibly hard. But repenting doesn't involve excuses or justification. And if we're dealing with a sin that's had a hold on us for a period of time or has become a pattern of thought or a habit, we need to renounce the effect that it's had in our lives and acknowledge that just by giving it airspace, we've given the devil a foothold in that area. And by renouncing that sin, we are claiming back that ground in our hearts for God. And after you've done this, you need to take time to receive God's forgiveness. You know, Jesus died on the cross for us that we might all receive his forgiveness. And we need to take time to sort of live there and be with him in his forgiveness. We also need to rebuke the sin and break off any spiritual hold or influence that it has on you in this area. And then you need to replace the sin with a new way of thinking and being. We need to renew our mind. And for all of us, this is going to be an ongoing process. It's not easy. I've been at it for 18 years and still I'm finding stuff that needs renewing. But I'm just going to finish by looking back at David and Saul. So Saul started out his kingship and his new life with God with some amazing God experiences, but they were not enough to sustain him through the rest of his life. He needed to actively decide to renew his mind with God, and he doesn't. But David, we see him as a man who goes after God's heart. He does stuff up spectacularly, but when he sins and he's confronted with it, he repents wholeheartedly. When Nathan the prophet goes to him and tells him what he's done wrong, this is in 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 13, David says, I have sinned against the Lord. And and the psalm that he writes in response to this is Psalm 51, and I've got a shortened version of it. David says, have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions, wash away all my sin. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. Cleanse me with hyssop and I will be clean. Wash me and I'll be whiter than snow. Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. We all mess up. We all have impurities in our lives that stop us from seeing God clearly. And we all have a choice as to how we're going to deal with them.